here. He has been spotted. Officially spotted.
Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue to order. We have a very full agenda today, so no wasted words by anyone, and we'll get through it. We will start out with the Core Systems Replacement Project Update from the Department of Revenue. Who wants to come and present that?
I can say a couple things.
Oh, Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to update the committee on some of the activities with Department of Revenue. They've been working to prepare for the 2013 budget with the Core System Replacement Project. They're reviewing their business case, and as you recall, the issue that was of particular interest in this committee from the February session was over the funding options and the benefit approach to funding versus more traditional approaches. We are working with the department on that, reviewing those options. We have been having biweekly meetings with the Legislative Fiscal Office and DOR with Eric and his folks. And so we've been proceeding on this with the intent of having something ready for consideration in 2013.
Okay. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Eric Smith, and I'm the administrator of the Program Management Office of the Department of Revenue. And Ken Ross and I today are just going to give a very quick update. I'm going to share just what we've done since February and what we're doing to get ready for the 2013 session regarding the project. And then Ken's going to share three policy concepts that we've been discovering while we've been working on our core systems replacement project that we're going to bring forward to you that we think make sense for conversation. So give a high-level overview of that. I don't know if we have the... Did we have the handout? Okay. Just a very, very brief reset of the context. In discovering that we need to replace our systems, the drivers were, again, for risk avoidance so that we can continue to sustain the revenue streams that you've asked us to administer. To improve performance, because there is a lot of opportunity we're discovering as we go further down this path to take advantage of 21st century technology to improve our performance. And there are opportunities to increase revenue generation because of that improved performance. So just as a refresh, those are the drivers for why we're looking at replacing our systems. The business case that you will see that we've presented is our agency request with our budget to the governor. In it has two primary conversations, one about the options we've considered for replacing our systems, and then secondly, it sets up the conversation that we had in February about what are the options to fund this. And if you notice to the right of that diagram that I gave you, that decision tree, we are still working on that. We now have a lot of detail that we did not have when we met with you in February because we spent a lot of time with the vendor where we can set the stage for what the fixed costs will be, what a benefits-based methodology might be. Legislative revenue staff were very helpful. We had a member from Office of Economic Analysis at the table with us, very helpful in trying to find what a benefits-based methodology might look like for Oregon. And so we'll be able to provide that in 2013, and we're also looking into what would it look like from the state's perspective if we were to finance it, say using the traditional certificate of participation. And I know, Senator Morris, that was a big interest of yours as well. So we're working with legislative fiscal staff and trying to get that information put together by December as an addendum to our business case because we just got the information by June with the work we were doing with the vendor.
And let me just break in for half a second. The fund option on the funding options, that's just basically an appropriation, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Chair Burdick, yes, that is correct. Okay. And so that's really the update that I have for you today. I mean, you're going to have three decisions basically in 2013. Should we replace our systems? If so, how should we fund that? And then what I'd like to do is unless you have questions on this portion of my update, have Mr. Ross give an update of three of the policy choices that will be coming your way.
Okay, why don't we hear all of them and then we'll open it up for questions.
Okay, good morning, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Ken Ross from Department of Revenue. As Eric said, we, in going through this process, developing the business requirements, we've identified three areas where we think develop a legislative concept to help take advantage of new system. We think these were also good administrative policy discussions for the systems we have now. There's something that we could, things that we could do now. The first concept that we'll bring in 2013 is we've titled it alternative notification methods. Right now, the law requires that we send all our notices, like our notices of deficiencies, by regular mail, so through the post office. There was a law passed in 2013 that allows agencies to use email in some situations. We would like to just expand on that to give us the opportunity for other methods. Could fax something, which probably that's becoming a little more archaic, but what we envision maybe is something like what you do when you opt out of when you go paperless with your bank statement or your electric bill, where we might send an email and then have the notice posted on a secure website. So like, again, it's just something that we think would allow us to be more efficient. We have two concepts that we're going to bring forward that have to do with our garnishment notices, the notices that we send to the financial institutions and the employers. So when we garnish bank accounts and wages, the first one is has to do with certified mail. Right now, the law says we have to send those notices by certified mail. It costs us $5 plus a pop. We would like to. This concept would allow us to send it either by regular mail or in certain situations with permission from the recipient, send it by email. So if we do business with a regular customer like a U.S. bank, maybe we could set up an electronic process. We actually brought this concept in 2011. It was heard in the House Judiciary Committee. We worked through some issues that the industry had that had to do with sanctions and getting a notice or not getting a notice. If it didn't come certified, how would we know they got it? We worked through that. We put language in there to say, if we don't get a response from you, we'll send a second notice and we'll send it certified. So at the time, in 11, we estimated it to allow us to send by regular mail would save about $500,000 a biennium. The number we bring in 13 will probably be higher than that because we're sending more garnishment notices now. And then the third concept has to do with modifying what we do, how we prepare the garnish notice. Garnishment notice, sorry. Right now, the law requires that we do a physical hand signature on every notice. So we send our file to state printing. They print them, and they send a hard copy back to our building. We hand sign every one of them and then send them out. So it's a little labor-intensive, and it adds a couple of steps and a few days to the process. The law also requires that we attach a copy of the warrant, so what gets filed with the county, which could add up to 10 pages to the notice. We'd like to change that so we don't have to hand sign one and we don't have to attach the entire notice or the warrant. That maybe we could do something like there's 4 pages of instructions. Maybe with like our repeat customers, we wouldn't have to send them that every time. Maybe we could post that on a website and give them a link to go to. So those are the three concepts that we have that we'd like to discuss in 13. And I'll take questions.
Thank you. Well, questions on both the topics. Let me start out with the computer replacement. I understand you had a presentation to the Ways and Means Committee, and I just sort of heard drifting comments from my colleagues who are on Ways and Means, and there seemed to be a high interest by the Ways and Means Committee in pursuing a COP strategy as opposed to a benefits-based. Some of my colleagues were very concerned about the benefits-based approach. So can you kind of address that, the kind of the pros and cons? I think the fund option is not really realistic because we just don't have the money rolling around to do a flat-out appropriation. So can you kind of give a sense of what the pros and cons of the benefits base versus the COP as you described it to the Ways and Means people?
Yes, Chair Britt, are you speaking to Wednesday's e-board conversation?
Correct.
Okay. Actually, I felt that we heard some very direct communication that was very helpful for the department that we've actually been looking for a while with regard to the direction we've been taking. We've been, for a little bit of background, we've been very transparent, over the last year that part of our strategy, one of our foundational assumptions in how we can get the information you need to make a decision was to go forward and negotiate a contract, being very transparent to the vendor community that it was conditional to legislative approval. But because a benefits-based methodology is something we've never done, for you to have enough information to be able to make a decision about whether that's a viable option, and based on our conversations with many other revenue agencies that have done this, it is an option to consider. We told people, I remember even testifying, that we were going to continue negotiating that contract to get information. I never heard any direct concern about that. And if my previous director had, it didn't come to me. So I just want to set that context that we've been very transparent that we've been wanting to do that. What I heard in the e-board hearing on Wednesday was there was a lot of concern about that, that we had prior to getting approval from the legislative body, gone forward and negotiated a contract. And so that was the first time that I had clearly heard that as a concern. I was frankly a little surprised only because I had been testifying to that even in February. And so I was glad to hear that that's a concern. And then directly to your question, we are well positioned to give you the bookends quite readily. Our net benefit analysis will be if we do nothing with our current systems, over the next decade, here's what it'll cost the state of Oregon. Here are the risks and the benefits associated and the opportunity costs associated with that. With the concrete information we have from negotiating the contract, we can say if we implement a commercial off-the-shelf solution using the benefits-based model that we negotiated, here is the total cost of the state of Oregon over the next 10 years. And then if we were to look at an alternative financing method, such as financing a certificate of participation, here are what we believe the cost to the state will be, but there will be a few variables that we won't be able to answer because our request for proposal did not consider the state paying for it. It considered the vendor paying for it and then them being paid back out of benefits base. So we'll be able to set up what we estimate the cost to be, but there will be a couple of unknown costs. One will be because we'd have to go back out for a new bid, we don't know what that cost of the contract would be in that. And we'll be able to articulate those and give a range based on what other states are paying of what it would be. I know.
But you're talking about the same off-the-shelf technology, regardless of whether it's COP or benefits-based, right? You're talking about the same system, correct?
Chair Burdick, correct. The challenge is the prices on these are going up, and I don't mean that threatening in any way. It's just a reality. One of the vendors who bid on our project bid in another state a year later on a benefits base, and their price was 3 times higher for a state that's not much larger than ours. And so there's just some uncertainty. It's a pretty small vendor pool, and they bid against each other. It's not like going and getting a Microsoft product where there's a lot of competition for that. There's a very, very small pool of vendors bidding against each other for the business. And so there's just a higher degree of risk, and we will point that out to you in our business case. And we can share with you what other states have paid outright. I believe Oregon negotiated a very good contract with this benefits-based, and when you see the information, you'll see, I know Senator Morse, one of your concerns was how much more of a premium are we paying for this because of it being benefits-based. We aren't paying much more. We are paying a little bit, but not much more. And when you weigh out what is the cost of financing it through a certificate of participation, the time value of money, what is the real benefit? Because we deferred, another point, too, we deferred a year. When we originally requested for bids on the proposal, we thought we would get approval in 2012 to begin implementation. During negotiations, we delayed it until 2013. The vendor has kept the price that they bid in 2011, and under the current model, their first payment to them won't come until late 2014 or early 2015. So there's some, from a financial perspective, there's some information we can lay out in terms of where is the true cost of the state going to come from, depending on which choice we choose.
And when will we see those analyses?
Our goal is to have them complete by December, when the governor has to have his budget in, and so we'd be able to come back in December and give more in-depth conversation about that at that time.
The other concern I heard from my colleagues was that the benefits-based program basically dealt the legislature out in terms of oversight.
Mm-hmm.
Can you, and I'm sure that came up in your meeting, can you address what, you know, what kind of oversight the legislature would have under that approach, if any?
Chair Burdick, I believe that the early involvement of legislative staff when we were negotiating the contract, and we heard from you in February that you had a very strong interest in making sure that we had legislative staff involved in how that was developed, had a big influence on the outcome of the model that the vendor proposed is not anything like the model that's in the contract. And I think that we reduced some of the risks that the state was exposed to from the vendor's proposed model to where we're at now. It's a capped price on the contract. There's a price that they will not be paid any more than, period. And there's a fixed date when the period of time that fund is available ends. And so if the receipts that we're going to be tracking to put into the fund are not met by the time that period is met, it's over. And so the vendor risks not being fully paid under the model we've proposed. And I think that is some of the safeguards through the help of legislative staff that we were able to put into the model, and we can get into those details at a later time. Our plan was to get into those details at a later committee, but I can share more now if you're interested.
Are there other questions from the committee? Senator Telfer.
I would say as a CPA and my fellow CPAs, would encourage us to move forward as fast as possible. I mean, there's a lot of frustration on the archaic system that we do have to deal with. The question I have on the COP versus the benefits-based, is it really kind of a question as to who we're paying, ourselves or somebody else? I mean, I assume the COPs are going to be paid through savings. How are we going to handle the COPs? How would we handle the COPs?
Senator Burdick, Senator Telfer, I'm not prepared to answer that question in much detail. I'm working with our budget staff on understanding the mechanics of that to get ready for December, and so I wouldn't want to speculate on that today, but we will certainly have great detail for you to understand what the bottom line impact is for the state, you know, what are the total costs of actually using a certificate of participation, excuse me, because there's a cost borne by the state even to go through that financing model as well, and we will lay those side by side for you, but I'm not prepared today to give you those specifics. I apologize.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Morris.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I think Senator Telfer, just to tag on to the direction she was going, do you have the capacity to do a return on investment analysis comparative to the COP and the benefits-based? That's really, I think, what the legislature is looking for, mm-hmm. is the greatest return on investment.
Chair Burdick, and Senator Morse, that's exactly what we're going to provide you.
Okay.
With a net benefit to the state.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. If there are no other questions, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to your detailed analysis. Anything else on this topic, Paul?
More to follow in December.
More to follow in December.
Thank you.
Okay. We will now move to our second item on the agenda, which is the Shared Services Fund, i.e. gain sharing from Washington County. So,
Madam Chair, just by way of a little background on this issue, it is the Shared Services Fund was created through the passage of Senate Bill 954 in 2007. It was a bill that came through the Senate Revenue Committee and became law at that time. There were lags in terms of when it went into effect, and we haven't seen an effect from it yet, and the bill directs the Department of Administrative Services, working with the Office of Economic Analysis, to estimate the amount of tax revenue that would be associated with strategic investment program investment, incremental investments going forward. DAS is to calculate what the income taxes would be from the wages earned at those particular projects, take 50% of that, and put it into this fund. So we are now at the point where we do have a project, particularly in Washington County, that would meet the criteria of the bill. We do have some issue around the implementation, whether the issue is, does the Department of Revenue actually have the statutory authority to transfer the income tax collections into the fund that's established at DAS. So we're working on that issue to determine if there needs to be any further legislation. And we do have, at the chair's direction, we have a placeholder bill that we're going to request for 13 session if we need any modifications to grant that authority. So that's where we are at this point. We estimated the revenue impact at that time for this biennium from 2007. We estimated the 11-13 revenue impact of $4.5 million. Based on the preliminary evidence we see, we think that there will be more funds that would be transferred into that fund based on the activity we've seen at this point.
And what magnitude, roughly?
Well, we haven't seen any precise calculations, but we're looking at probably in excess of $10
million. So more than double what we had anticipated. Okay. Dennis.
Good morning. Chair Burdick and committee members, I'm Dennis Mulvihill. Here representing Washington County, along with the chairman of the Board of County Commissioners, Andy Dyke, and Rob Massers, Assistant County Administrator. You'll hear from them shortly. I get to do the warm-up here. So with your indulgence, I want to take one little side step here. In previous appearances, my introduction included the title of Government Relations Manager for Washington County. Here recently, I claimed my PERS and went to halftime. The new person who's going to replace me is here in the audience, John Schlieder. And I want to use this opportunity to officially pass the torch. I'm sure you'll take as good a care of him as you have me. So.
We'll drive him to retirement, too, I'm sure.
So with that, thank you for providing Washington County, the City of Hillsborough, Metro, and the Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue District this opportunity to discuss gain share. My role today is to provide an abridged history of what happened those many years ago. Discussions at the local level to approach the legislature about making this type of a policy change started in about 2005, actually. And it took us until about 2007 to really come down here and say, look, we have this idea. When we came down here, we found that there was three arguments that really made a difference with legislators. We were finding at the local level in Washington County and other places that public resistance to property tax abatement programs was getting increasingly difficult. Studies showing that the macroeconomic benefits that would accrue to the state if you did these SIP programs were not effective. They were losing their effectiveness in gaining the public support. It was also impossible to prove that foregone property taxes would bring new revenue back to the local community and even partially offset those diverted funds that could be used for other popular programs at the local level. So we were getting anxious about it. Taxing districts in Washington County and other places, the state wanted to be pistons in the economic engine, but they needed a way to demonstrate to their constituents that taking some risk and diverting a portion of their precious property taxes would help produce economic growth and get a return on investment. So that's what we were down here trying to do. And that argument resonated with legislators at the time. During the same period, the legislature was given a lot of attention to reforming Oregon's tax system overall. And the gain share idea was proposed as a method to promote the addition of additional income taxes for the state. The state could gain more income taxes using property taxes, and all they had to do was share some of the gain share, if you will. In fact, that's where the idea was, you know, that concept, that moniker came from. I think the third and most compelling argument with legislators was that of fairness. If local taxing districts were willing to partner with the state by investing their time, it takes an inordinate amount of time for cities and county to sit down and negotiate with these world-class companies who bring a lot of horsepower to the table. And if we were able to negotiate an SIP agreement that generated income tax revenues, then those local governments deserved a share of it. Legislative support for the policy, I think it's fair to say, was strong. You know, the vote was strong. In fact, at one stage in the process, the shared amount, now it's 50-50, but the shared amount was 75-25. 75% for the local governments, 25% for the state. And we were convinced by the Revenue Committee, of which some of you were on, that a 50-50 was probably a better deal.
Mm-hmm.
There was even, and this is an interesting point, to just try to convey why it was a popular idea, and there was even some talk about applying this gain share policy to enterprise zones. Enterprise zones is the same sort of thing. Local government gives up property taxes, foregoes the collection of it for a certain amount of years. That attracts a good company or retains a good company, and they plant deeper roots. So that was, all of that resonated with the legislature. I'll close with this. When the first fiscal and revenue impact statements were generated by legislative staff on the Washington County SIP programs, that were expected to be put into effect. They weren't in effect, they were expected to be, but the company could walk too. We were uneasy about the small amount of projected income taxes that was being shared with the local governments. When you compared it to the foregone property taxes, we were looking for a way to convince the public, look, this is a good thing. Let us do this, and we'll generate income taxes, and some will come back. When the actual numbers became known recently, we thought it caused for celebration because the gain share policy had worked. It had generated even more than the estimated amount for the state. In other words, and I think you spoke to it when you were asking the question, is that we figured we would split about $9 million. We're going to end up splitting approximately, because we're not being told the exact numbers, but we'll probably be splitting $24 million. So the point being is that the state got more money out of the deal because we did what we said we would do, which we would use property taxes to get companies to expand, retaining a good world-class company or attracting a new one. So I will stop there, but I think the part that we'll find most interesting this morning is what Rob Masser is going to talk about. He will talk about the economic benefits that have happened, as well as the cost of the SIP program, in detail rather than in the abstract, as I've done. Thank you.
Welcome.
Good morning, Senators. Really appreciate this time to what we believe is celebrate the successes of the Strategic Investment Program and the Gainshare Program. My name is Rob Masser. I am currently the Assistant County Administrator with Washington County, and prior to that, I was the Assistant City Manager with the City of Hillsborough for over 10 years, and during that period of time, negotiated several of the strategic investment programs with Washington County. So I do have some background on that. You know, when I was driving home last night, I was thinking about what I would say to the committee, and I was listening to NPR, and a real disturbing fact came across in the program. I was listening to an NPR, and I know you've heard this fact, that long-term unemployment in this country is at the highest it's been since the Great Depression. To me, that just illustrates the extraordinary times that we're in right now. And when we have extraordinary times, I think it requires extraordinary measures. And I think that's what we have. We have the Strategic Investment Program and the Gainshare Program, very bold programs. I think they're necessary in these times. And with the Strategic Investment Program and the Gainshare Program, these really are partnerships with local government, regional government, and state government. It's really a partnership. And the benefits are extremely high out of those programs. They're adding and retaining jobs with salaries that many times are over three times the average salary in the state of Oregon. In fact, that really is the reason, as Dennis talked about, that we're estimating these gain share payments to be so much higher than we originally estimated them. Not that there are more employees subject to this, but the wages are so much higher than we originally estimated. Twice to three times higher. So that higher wage has increased, of course, personal income, thus personal income tax, and as a result has raised gainshare payments too. So we really see this as a win-win for the state, for the regional, and for the local governments. There is no other economic development program in this state that has resulted in the type of investment that we've seen through the strategic investment and gainshare programs, nor the type of development of jobs that we've seen through this economic development program. And finally, I wanted to say that the gainshare program provides a lot more flexibility for local governments to be able to negotiate strategic investment programs in the future with potential companies. To continue the success of the SIP program, I think that's necessary to have that flexibility so that we can continue to attract investment in the state and creation of new jobs. I did want to go over a couple slides that are in your briefing book. I think it's on tab 6, the last two slides. And what these are attempting to do, the first slide, the heading is Washington County Strategic Investment Programs, SIP, for 2011. And this includes the Gainshare Program. And what this slide is attempting to do is to look at the local and regional governments and what are the revenues associated with the SIP program. What revenues are being generated locally in association with the SIP program and Gainshare? And then secondly, what are the foregone, what's the investment in the SIP program locally through foregone revenues, abated property tax? So on the revenue side, and this is again for 2011, and on the revenue side, the SIP programs, the straight SIP payments to local taxing districts is just under $12 million, about $11.8 million for 2011. The property tax for those SIP program companies, and if you remember, the first $100 million of investment goes straight onto the tax rolls under the SIP program. So those related property tax, just over $4 million in 2011. And if you add in the estimated gainshare payments, and I have $12 million here, we don't know what that is. We don't calculate that number, but we estimate it to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $12 million. If you add those three up, those are the SIP gainshare-related payments in 2011 to local taxing jurisdictions, and that's just over $28 million. Now, when I talk about local taxing districts, those revenues are shared not only with Washington County, but the City of Hillsborough, Metro, the Port, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, So they are shared amongst those overlapping taxing districts. And then conversely, looking at the investment that those local taxing districts have in the SIP program through abated property tax, foregone revenues, for 2011, that was just shy of $83 million, about $82.9 million foregone revenue, abated property tax in 2011. So, just to compare foregone revenues, $82.9 million to the SIP-related payments, just over $28 million. If you go to the next slide, what we attempted to do here is look at just the benefits of those companies to the statewide. What do we all benefit in having those companies in the state that are under SIP in Washington County? And statewide, those companies and related employment are generating over $270 million in personal income tax that we all benefit from. This is straight out of an Eco Northwest study in 2011. It also is responsible for approximately 90,000 jobs in the state of Oregon. And total economic impact to the state of Oregon is over $17 billion in 2011. And finally, these programs have enabled the initiation of the largest industrial expansion in the history of the state of Oregon, and that is the D1X plant that I know that you all are aware of in Intel in Washington County, which actually should be just completed. If not already, they will be occupying very, very soon in the D1X facility. And those are my comments, and I know there are others that would like to address the committee.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Any other?
Just one closing comment here, and that is that this about a year ago, there was a lot of press on Intel making investments in Washington County, and it was alluded to the D1X. That particular investment, which was at probably the lowest point of this economic malaise we're in, was made because of the SIP program that we did several years ago. And they started, that was the execution of the agreement they had with us. So it worked. That's our whole point, is that it worked. And not only did it worked at a really good time relative to the economy. Mm-hmm. Were it not for the property taxes foregone, those folks wouldn't have made the investments that they did.
Right.
Thank you.
Really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Why don't we go to the next panel call we have here. Andy Dyke, Aaron Carlson, and Michael Brown.
Good morning, Chair Burdick and Senators. We appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I'm joined by City Councilor, Hillsborough City Councilor Aaron Carlson, and City Administrator Michael Brown. This is rather interesting being here today.
You put your name on the record.
I'm sorry. Yes. I tend to forget that. I'm Andy Dyke. I'm the Chair of the Washington County Board of Commissioners. Thank you. It's interesting to be here in a situation where we are here because we are so successful. And I remember the discussion about Senate Bill 954 when it was developed back in 2007. And as you heard from the previous speakers, the taxing districts in Washington County had given up a tremendous amount of revenue, somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 to $60 million. And that's great. We gave it up, but the need to provide services was still there. The county still needed that revenue to provide the services for the Intel employees and for the other SIP recipients as well. And And so it became a matter of fairness that we develop a different type of mechanism to get back part of our investment. And that's really what Senate Bill 954 was all about. Most of you, if not all of you, were here in 2007, and I think that you went through this and supported that bill at that time. It was a good decision then, and it still makes sense today. This really is a partnership. That's the way we look at it. It's not just all about the county, and it's not just all about the state. It's a partnership. And we believe as partners, we went into it together, we made an investment, and we hope that that we'll both receive the returns on that investment. And I think the reason we're here today is because we have. It would appear that the angst really is over the amount, because the amount of money has turned out to be more money than any of us anticipated. And that's a good thing. I mean, that's the kind of problems that you want to have. If the amount exceeds the expectations, it's because the state itself has received more money than it expected from this program. As we said, we gave up about $50 to $60 million, but as you heard previously, the return to the state has been somewhere in the neighborhood of $270 million in income tax from the recipients of SIP agreements and from the suppliers and the contractors and all of the other entities that feed into that. And I can tell you from personal experience, my own business, Dyke Machine Incorporated, we're a manufacturing company. We probably would not have made it through the recession but for these SIP agreements, because we became a customer of one of the SIP recipients. And that made a big difference to us and to each and every one of our employees and their families. But again, the county still has to provide the services for all of those employees. And so we need this partnership to continue so that we can get back at least a part of our investment. Washington County has been fortunate with two major SIP investments that involve gainshare. And we, along with the state and the private employers that receive those agreements, we really are a full partnership. And I would think that this would be the kind of partnership that we not only want to continue, but we want to foster and increase, because this is really what makes the state grow economically. We need to look back at what the state would be had we not done those agreements. That would really give us a little bit more contrast over whether or not we're making the right move or not. The Strategic Investment Program and the Shared Services Fund that was created by the 2000 legislature, again, really it really proved far more successful than anybody estimated. And I would like to leave you with the thought that that really isn't a bad problem. So to help encourage that investment, if you could somehow straighten this out and make it flow smoothly so that we can continue the program, we would appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you. Just before we move on, I think it's definitely the intent of this committee and the legislature in general to solve the technical problem. The issue we're dealing with really is the how to set the formula, because one of the things that has occurred to me is, has anyone done, you talk about you need the money to provide the services for the additional employees. But has anyone done any kind of analysis of how many employees, the cost per employee, if you will, of providing services for non-SIP and for SIP companies? Because the SIP people do, they do pay into the system. And so the question is, you're losing some tax revenue, but you're also getting more revenue than you would have otherwise. And so what I'm trying to figure out is how that hydraulic works. You've got the SIP people who are in a unique category, because these are high depreciation, high capital value deductions that you're working with here. So it's any of that kind of analysis?
I don't know if the analysis has been done in that way, but as you know, local government is very property tax dependent. Mm-hmm. And the criticism, as you've heard previously from the previous speakers, is that we are giving up that property tax, which could be then used locally for better services.
Correct, but you're also getting more than you would have if there was nothing there. And that's what I'm trying to determine is, you know, how that compares to non-SIP situations on an employee basis.
Yeah, I don't have those numbers, unfortunately. But
maybe we'll put Paul on.
But again, but as you know, SIP agreements become political in nature, and local governments have to they have to deal with the public and make a good case for doing those agreements. And it's very difficult to do them if we are giving up a significant amount of income. It's difficult to tell the public, but still, we're still getting back some income from the first $100 million of assessed value. It's difficult to tell them that and tell them, yet we're capping it at $100 million. The public would like to see a better investment than that. So in order to continue to encourage local officials to make these agreements, it takes a little bit more than just saying we're only going to get tax on that first $100 million.
Move on.
Good morning, Chair Burdick and Senators. Thank you for having us. I'm Erin Carlson, Hillsborough City Council President, and Michael Brown, City Manager. So we're here today to support the county in their gain share remarks that they have been making today, but also to support that current Senate bill, the intent of it, Senate Bill 954. It reminds us all of the gain share revenue, the promises that were made to our community who invest the revenues to help programs that support for the bigger sectors in our community and their job growth. The gain share performance has exceeded the initial revenue expectations, largely because Hillsborough's made a huge capital investment since the 1990s to support the new companies and has offered those SIP incentives to attract them and to keep them here and to encourage them to hire more. We did this a long time before the gain share and will continue to do so as we move forward. Our residents have been incredibly supportive of Intel and Genentech and the other companies in our community, and we continue to make the investments in their companies, as well as spending the tax dollars on roads and water and sewer. And we've even provided our school district with over $1.4 million of in-kind services directly to our school district through resource officers using our parks maintenance for the grounds of maintaining the grounds of their schools and hosting their activities such as football and swimming and soccer. And in your binder under tab one, there is information about how our community has supported the district as well as other stakeholders. Your votes in that gain share program were important to us. As we know through data collected by Metro, that four of the five workers that do those jobs reside outside of our city, and that our residents are having to provide the roads and the amenities for those employees as they come in for those jobs. And our community has remained faithful to maintaining those programs, and we've even used $1 million a year for the last several years of our SIP money for road maintenance, and yet those residents don't pay into our tax base directly as residents of our community, as 80% of them live outside of the area. So we've helped bring in these revenues to the state and to the community, and our specific residents of Hillsborough have made investments that help support the rest of the state. And we have known that Senate Bill 954 would have our backs, and that with all of the revenue that the state has received from that we are looking to move forward and hope that we can get this resolved and get those funds back into the community. So thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you.
Jim, anything you want to add?
Hillsborough has definitely been a bright, shining light in the economic development front.
Welcome. Thank you, Chair Burdick, Senators. My name is Michael Brown, the City Manager of the City of Hillsborough. It's an honor to be in front of you today. My comments will be very brief. Intel is an extraordinary company, and we're at the ground level with them. We're in a strong partnership with Intel, and the level of effort, the investment that we make as a city in our operations and our projects, infrastructure, to cater to the needs of them, which we have pride in doing, and we believe we do an exceptional job of that, not just for Intel, but for all the other companies that are associated with that economic engine of the high-tech, semiconductor, biopharmaceutical companies. We do an exceptional job of working with them, partnering with them, listening to their needs. And in the packet, we provided some information about that level of investment that we currently do with regard to the complexity of the types of things that we have to deal with at the staff. We have to go through extraordinary efforts to train our staff to have them be able to respond to those types of needs. The level of investment for things like water, infrastructure, are huge. And it requires strong partnerships. So when they talk about the partnerships we have with Washington County, with a variety of different agencies around it, it takes all of us to meet those needs. And so we're investing that regularly. So we're also, we're pretty well known for being visionary. We've had that history when Intel originally arrived, the way that went about with leadership from folks there about having them come there. And the vision that we have in planning for the future of what those needs are. We're right now, and one of the highlights of the handout was we're looking out 15, 20 years from now, what it's going to take to serve the water needs. That's a $300 to $600 million project. That's significant. So even with Gainshare, it's not that we view Gainshare as our return on investment, and we've counted on that. But I'll just tell you, that's a small part of what it's going to take to continue to put the investment and reinvestment in to have that continue to be the economic engine that it is in our state. So I take great pride in the role I have with the city in having us have a history of having the burden, the responsibility of catering to, supporting the needs of that industry. We do a fantastic job. It's the best place, in my opinion, where the fund should be placed to continue to be, to respond to the needs of that industry. So with that said, that was all my comments. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. And by the way, it's a beautiful place. This is the first time I've been in this facility, and appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Telfer.
You know, the issues I've heard are no different than any other community, particularly my community in Central Oregon. You know, the infrastructure being used by people who aren't paying for it, et cetera, economic development issues. Are there other communities using this, or is this a situation of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer throughout the state? Since income taxes are shared statewide or utilized statewide, property taxes are more local.
Are you talking specifically about the Gainshare program?
Yes.
Yes.
Let's wait and have our next panelist address that, because Mike MacArthur from AOC is going to be here.
Okay.
That would be a good idea.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Brody.
I'll let you off the hook here.
Thank you. Thanks. I just more of a comment than anything else. I want to thank the Washington County folks for coming down and the Hillsborough City folks for coming down, and I know this is a very big issue, but I just want to make sure that we keep this in perspective, that a year ago April, the President of the United States came to Washington County because of the economic activity that was going on primarily with Intel, and that is exactly what was hoped for with these incentive programs, a $6 billion investment just right there in that one site, and that's what this is all about. And I'll tell you something else about Intel. I have a lot of Intel employees in my district, and there's a certain they're great employees because they're well paid, they're well educated. You see them volunteering in our schools, you see them coaching soccer teams, and there's a certain ethos there that makes for a really, really strong community in Washington County and Hillsborough and Beaverton. So my hope is that we can fix this technical glitch and continue on as planned.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, we'll move to our next panel. Mike MacArthur and the other Dyke, Mike Dyke.
Good morning, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. I'm Mike MacArthur. I'm the executive director of the Association of Oregon Counties. But I'm here also this morning with another perspective, and that is as a former Sherman County judge. And When I was at Sherman County, I spent 25 years running a small-time gambling operation, otherwise known as a dryland wheat farm. We had a saying that we did two things in Sherman County. We exported wheat and kids, because the economic opportunities in Sherman County were very few. In about 2000, we caught a break. We had a local developer that wanted to try a wind farm, 16 turbines, 24 megawatts. That proved to be successful. We now have almost 1,500 megawatts. So my formerly pristine view of the North Cascades, Mount Rainier, is now populated with red lights. But Sherman County, I guided them to 35th place in per capita income. They're now number two. And the development and the rollout of that wind development was largely a result of the SIP program that we put in place when I was there, the policies that we adopted. There aren't a lot of jobs associated with wind farms, but there are some. And I call your attention to page tab 7, I think it is, and there's a chart that shows how the SIP program has played out. Is with regards to the wind farms. There are SIP agreements in about four different counties and some pending in other counties, Union, Sherman, Gillam, Morrow. They're also pending in Harney and Crook, I believe. But this program has had a huge impact on those counties. And the reason it works for the wind development is because the projects are valued with the income approach. They're centrally assessed, valued at the income approach. And at the start, because of the federal production tax credit, there's fairly high value. So if they paid straight property tax, that would be a big hit to the developer because they've just spent all the capital. Those projects are very capital intensive up front. And then they have to pay full property tax at the beginning before they've started to generate much income. With the SIP, the counties agree to a levelized program over 15 years. They reduce the amount of property taxes paid at the front end, and it's actually higher at the back end because of the nature of the agreements. So it works for the county. It has a steady stream of income in the other taxing districts, and it works for the developer because it minimizes their costs at the front end, and then when they have the income later on, they're able to keep up with the SIP agreements. Many of these SIP agreements you'll see are adjusted for the actual value. And just to give you an example of how the value changes, I looked at one wind farm, Willow Creek in Gillam County, was valued at $51 million in 2009, and in 2012 it's at $36 million. So you can see how rapidly the value goes down with the accelerated depreciation and the production tax credit, which expires, I think, after 9 years. So, anyway, that's been an important program. And so even with this great investment in Sherman County and the fact that the Sherman County and the other counties that have invested in these wind projects are helping the state meet its renewable energy goals, we're on pace to make the 15% by 2015, largely because of the wind farms. And so that's another benefit. So, but even so, Sherman County continues to struggle economically. The population's still flat. The school district's losing population. And so this program, while maybe not necessarily foreseen for the wind farms, has had a benefit and will have a benefit. And the counties, all the counties that are doing these wind farm projects are forgoing huge amounts of property tax. And so the gain share program makes sense for them too, even though it's much smaller than, say, Washington County because of the fewer employees. This lists about 165 employees for all these projects. I don't believe the Harney County project with 15 and the Golden Hills projects with 20 have not gone forward, but I believe all the rest of the projects have been constructed. So, anyway, that's the story from the wind counties that are also using the SIP and are eligible for the gain share. Now, from the county's perspective statewide, I call your attention to what we call the JAWS. Dr. Warner produced this in 2007. I think maybe Paul, it's time to to redo it based on the market values decline.
Yeah.
But counties face a structural deficit. We're dependent on property taxes, which are limited by the Constitution, by the initiatives that we have, Measure 5 and 50. The growth is capped at 3% plus new construction. But our costs for health insurance, retirement, employee costs are continuing to increase at a greater rate. So the property tax is not a sufficient tool to fund local government. And it's particularly insufficient in Southwest Oregon, as I'm sure you've heard, those counties are struggling. But throughout the state, all counties face this problem of not having, being able to keep up with the cost of providing services. So you're seeing reductions. And Gary Blackmer testified yesterday in front of County Payments Task Force. They've done a study of the Secretary of State sent a study I call your attention to. They have some per capita figures for how much each county is spending, for instance, on public safety. You know,
that's a separate issue from the gain share. I mean, that's a far bigger issue.
I'm saying the gain share helps. My point here is that having the gain share helps narrow those jaws a little bit.
Right.
Thank you.
Maybe you could address Senator Telfer's question about the relationship between counties, the have and have not counties, from your AOC perspective. So why don't you restate your question?
Well, the question was, how many other? I mean, I see a handful of counties. Mm-hmm. How broadly utilized is this throughout the state? Is it just?
Washington County, Multnomah County, and the counties that are have the SIP with wind farms are the ones that I'm familiar with.
So it's minimal, really. Mm.
Right. At this point.
Okay. Chief Dyke.
Thank you, Senator. Members of the committee, my name is Mike Dyke. I'm the fire chief at Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, which is Oregon's largest fire district. We serve 440,000 people in portions of Washington, Clackamas, and Multnomah counties. 210 square miles in total, serving 9 cities. We have approximately 450 employees and 60 volunteer firefighters. Our sole revenue source is property taxes. Chair Dyke and others have spoken about the Gainshore program in great detail, and I can offer a perspective of what this program means to a local government partner. TVFNR very much understands the added economic value of investment that property tax abatement can have. And much like the county, we too benefit from these existing agreements. Gainshare offers a portion of the income taxes as a partial replacement of the property tax revenue and the distribution to TVFNR that we'd expected to offset the property tax revenue not received. This is, in fact, a return on investment. I'd like to offer you a perspective of what TVFNR would use our share of the return on providing the community emergency services, which require personnel, equipment, and station infrastructure to respond to the growth from industrial and corresponding residential and business development. So we support this tool as part of the economic development package that is available, and like to congratulate, in fact, the Oregon Legislature for establishing it. TVFNR hopes to see this used in the future. So thank you. Happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you, and we look forward to hearing you on the next agenda item.
See you
after
in a few
the
minutes.
Next one. questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Okay. Now we will move on to our next agenda item, the tax competitiveness study.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I'm going to go to the witness stand. Chris will join me and Dustin, our summer intern, who's worked with us on this project. Our intent will be to update the committee on the project, and we'll spend a few minutes with that, and then we'll be followed by a panel who's been assisting us in working on the project.
Perfect. Thank you.
I'm not going to expect you to.
It was one of our panelists, by the way. So.
Yes, we're very familiar with with the good Randy Miller.
Yes. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. With me is Chris Allenack, LRO, and Dustin Bishop, who is our intern from Willamette this summer. He's back starting a senior year now, but has come back and has helped us with his project. So we ask him to come and participate with us. We have been working. This was something that was on the work plan going back to the fall, and we began working on the details of it after the February session, and we're at the point where we shouldn't have any problem having a complete report to you in December. That is our intent to come back. But we've done enough work. I thought it would be helpful to update you where we're at and then to give you an opportunity to give us some direction if there's some further things you want us to pursue within the context of the study. I have an outline in your packet. It's has our research report logo on it, and it's outlined taxation and Oregon's interstate competitiveness. So our intent in this project is to narrow down one aspect of how economic development takes place and its relationship to state and local taxation. There's a couple of things to keep in mind, and we have a detailed discussion of this in our full report. Taxes and economic development, there is a relationship empirically, but the relationship is not a strong one. And what that is telling us is there are a lot of other factors besides state and local taxes that influence economic growth. And I mean, that when you think about it, that makes sense. There's a whole series of factors that would influence the location of capital and labor that would be far beyond certainly tax policy, but even beyond state and local fiscal policy when you include the expenditure side as well. So we have a detailed discussion of that in the report, and our intent is to fully set the context of the study through that discussion. But what I'd like to share with you today is the focus we have on the business location and expansion decisions. And so we're really narrowing this to C corporations primarily, large corporations who are making an investment decision in a state and would do this in some type of comparative analysis. So we're approaching this really in three ways. One is there have been two recent studies that have come out that are very detailed, and we spent a lot of time looking at those and trying to decipher the implications of those studies. The first is competitiveness of state and local business taxes on new investment, prepared by Ernst & Young for the Council of State Taxation, COST. And you may be familiar, COST goes through and has Ernst & Young do a state-by-state business taxes as an annual part of their annual report. So this is an offshoot of that on focusing on the effective tax rate of individual capital investment decisions. The second study, which really has a very similar objective, is location matters, comparative analysis of state costs on business, and this is through the Tax Foundation and was prepared by KPMG. So we have two very recent studies, and as far as the level of sophistication, these are probably state-of-the-art in terms of the methodology they use and the approach that they take. So we've started out from that perspective, using those studies as a starting point. We have asked the Oregon Business Association to put together a work group for us, chaired by Robert Manicky, and to review our methodology and to give us some suggestions on how to pursue this issue around competitiveness and how Oregon's tax system might affect business location decisions. We've met once with a panel, and we intend to meet again with them early next month on reviewing a full draft that we've done. And thirdly, we have met with the Department of Revenue corporate auditors and discussed with them tax return data on corporate income taxes, the kinds of issues that we'll get into in a minute around nexus, around apportionment. And we also, this will lead us, I think, into some areas for some bills for your consideration in 2013. The two studies that I mentioned, they're similar. They both set up a prototype corporation, making a location or expansion decision. They go on and compute the taxes of those particular investments. They look at sales taxes, corporate income taxes, property taxes, obviously a local revenue source, franchise taxes. A major difference in the two studies, and you'll see how that affects the results. The Ernst & Young study limits it to those taxes, whereas the Tax Foundation study includes unemployment compensation trust fund taxes, which does definitely have a relative impact on Oregon's ranking in the studies. And they also go in the Tax Foundation study, to try to specifically look at tax incentives in a kind of a limited way. They include the R&D credit, for example. The only other incentive they do use, and related to our previous topic, is the SIP. And they look at that because they look at investments assuming that these certain investments would be eligible for the SIP, in particular capital-intensive manufacturing investments. So, and again, both studies do acknowledge that a lot of other factors influence location besides taxes. So this is not a study of do taxes affect location, but rather, let's look at taxes, effective tax rates, compare that by state, and see how they would affect particular investments differently. If you look on page 2 of the study, or of the outline, it has the results of the two studies. And the calculated effective tax rates, Ernst & Young goes through and estimates them in two different ways, one by capital investment, the other weighted by jobs. The results are very similar for Oregon, not necessarily for all the states, but for Oregon they are. And similar to the results you've seen about the cost estimates for business taxes, Oregon ranks very high or very low in terms of its tax burden.
By high, you mean
yes.
A low tax
burden. Low tax, right. Competitive, yes. Okay. So, and if you go through some of the reasons for that, they're the same reasons why we have the low business tax. One is the absence of sales tax on business inputs, which can be a significant cost for certain types of investments. The single sales factor and the apportionment of corporate income. And one of the big differences in the two studies we'll see is their treatment of the sales factor. In fact, we don't have a franchise tax, but we also found that really none of the states in our region have one either, so it's not much of a competitive factor. And the other issue to keep in mind is that these are focused on direct business taxes, so they do not include the personal income tax. So, and of course, that makes sense that if you look at Oregon's taxes, we know about almost 70% of our state taxes come from the personal income tax. So most of so that leaves a relatively small non-personal income taxes, and that shows up in these studies as well.
Paul, which state is number one?
Number one in the cost study is Maine. So we don't consider them a regional competitor, although I guess for some things they may be. The Tax Foundation study reaches a lot different result. And they place the state right almost for, they divide investments into what they call mature firms versus new firms. The mature firms, the most important difference in terms of the study is the mature firms are not eligible for tax incentives, the new firms are. So their average, they break it down to an index, the effective tax rates for mature firms in Oregon is almost dead on the national average. And that ranks us 28th. We're a little above average in terms of the new firms, meaning that our incentives are not as strong as some other states. And there is a big difference in some of the states in terms of the mature and new firms. Nebraska, for example, is the lowest tax in terms of new firms because their incentives are very strong, even though their mature firms are about in the middle. The reason for the difference in the two studies, one obvious one is inclusion of unemployment insurance taxes. Our unemployment insurance taxes are relatively high, but I think you could raise a discussion point of whether that is a significant business cost. It is a business cost, but it also, you get a trade-off in terms of insurance trust fund that provides a stable trust fund over time, that if it's unstable, businesses will end up paying higher costs in the future to stabilize it, particularly now where we know a number of trust funds are on the verge of insolvency in the states that have inadequate revenue coming in. And Ernst & Young made the decision not to include that specifically for those reasons. The more important issue is the way that the single sales factor is incorporated. In the Ernst & Young study, they do not take account of the fact that Oregon has a throwback rule, which means that if sales go to a state in which a corporation does not have nexus under a throwback rule, those sales are thrown back into the originating state. So basically, the way the Tax Foundation calculates that, most of the sales end up being, a very big percentage of those sales end up being thrown back into Oregon. So that largely negates the competitive advantages of a sales factor. So one of the things that we've done, and Chris has worked on the corporate tax returns we have, and our preliminary estimate is that about 10% of sales are thrown back into the state. So if you have the comparison between a 0% and 100% throwback, it's closer to the zero or closer to the Ernst & Young assumption. But yet, that's still a simplifying assumption. For some businesses, it may be a very important caveat that they end up with a lot of sales in Oregon through the throwback rule. And that's something we want to pursue further. The other issue is around, as I mentioned, around the Tax Foundation does incorporate these investment incentives, and they do it, and it's difficult to do because you're looking at statewide incentives. As I say, they include the SIP, but they don't include enterprise zones as an incentive in the Tax Foundation methodology, and that's one of the major incentives that, of course, Oregon uses. So in that sense, there's a bias against Oregon and the use of incentives, although other states use them too. So that's kind of where we're at right now in terms of the study, looking at the results of the two studies and going from there. And we've begun to develop our own prototypes to try to flush out some of these differences and get a better understanding of how Oregon truly would rank in a competitiveness study. The first thing we've done is, and this is based on the advice of our advisory group, is to look at a more realistic comparison group. The input we've had is a corporation is not going to make a decision between investing in Oregon versus Florida, for example, or Maine. It's going to look at a regional kind of comparison. The market factors are the primary determinant of a general location. If you're setting up a distribution center or a manufacturing center to service a particular market, you're not going to make a national comparison. You're going to focus on a regional difference. So we think that, and we think this is pretty strongly supported in the literature, that taxes and tax differentials are most important at a regional level, where the other factors are fairly similar, like labor force quality, proximity to market, energy costs, so that taxes become more important on the margin. So that the group that we've are working with is Oregon, Washington, Idaho, California, and Colorado. So that's our subgroup. We are narrowing down to two primarily types of prototypes. One's a capital-intensive manufacturing, and the other is an exporter of services. And the exporter of services is of particular interest to us because the way that services are sourced is much different than the way tangible property is sourced through the apportionment formula. The single sales factor applies to tangible property being produced in Oregon and sold to another market. That would not count as an Oregon sale. A service that is produced in Oregon and maybe provided to a customer in Illinois, for example, would be counted as an Oregon sale if the service is actually performed in Oregon. It's called the cost of performance approach. So it's not, theoretically, it is not at all consistent with a sales factor approach through tangible goods. So we're looking at the implications of that. Some states, for example, California, have gone to a market-based service sourcing approach. So we've had some discussions with Department of Revenue on this, and we're going to trace through what the implications of that are, and they're significant. So that's kind of where we're pursuing it. The other area what we're interested in is looking at a headquarters operation, which is included in both studies, but then to factor in the impact of personal income taxes on high-income individuals that would be presumably associated with a headquarters-type operation to see if we can get a sense of how personal income taxes would affect our competitiveness within our regional group. So our intent is to develop those, get review and input from our advisory group, have further discussion with the Department of Revenue, and then come back to you with a final report in December. We think that there will be some general conclusions, and you can see that Oregon's ranking in these studies is very positive in terms of the Ernst & Young, and we think there's some issues around tax foundation that may suggest we're closer to the Ernst & Young overall conclusion based on the narrowness of this study than we are to the tax foundation. But we'll flesh that out for you and give you kind of some general conclusions, but we'll also have some specific kind of proposals around particularly the corporate income tax and around the use of destination-based sourcing versus origin sourcing. The one state that finished in the top five in both studies, interestingly, is Ohio. And Ohio has made a transformation from a corporate income tax to a gross receipts tax, and their gross receipts tax is entirely destination-based, meaning that if you're a company that's producing products, and we do have a couple of the companies that are in our advisory group are actually produce products in Ohio, sell them outside of Ohio, and because they're not destination Ohio, they're not counted in terms of the gross receipts tax. But those that sell into the state, because Ohio is the destination, are liable for those gross receipts taxes. So it's an interesting difference on this destination versus source-based.
Ones that sell out of state pay no tax then?
Your tax burden is based on your sales in Ohio. It's just like the single sales factor, only it's applied to gross receipts.
So for out of state, there's no tax burden at all.
There's no taxes for on the gross receipts you derive from sales outside the state. Just like we wouldn't have any through the sales factor, but that applies to net income, which is a lot more narrow base than gross receipts, which of course is a lot broader base. So it's more significant. It was interesting that Ohio is the only state that, in spite of the different methodologies, it comes out right on the top, near the top.
Okay.
So anyway, we hope to have more for you in December. And if there are things that you think we should look at based on kind of this discussion that would fit in this study, we'd certainly be happy to hear that and do our best to incorporate it.
So this is pretty much right now focused on C corporations.
Yes.
And there's really no way to include the impact on S corporations.
Madam Chair, we haven't done that specifically, but we're kind of going in the back door on this headquarters idea and building in the personal income tax and how it affects actually wage income under our prototype. But it would be similar to the effect on pass-through type organizations, because that would end up, that personal income tax would end up falling on the owners of that corporation. We're just calling them high wage headquarters individuals, but it would have that same economic effect.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Morris.
Thank you. This I think is very helpful work, but as I recall reading the studies that look at who the job creators are, that the net effect nationally of the large, and they would be C corps, is neutral to negative. But the job creators are the small businesses, which are the sub most likely to pass through corporate structure. How do we get at the tax competitiveness for, and this is your question, I think, Madam Chair, the tax competitiveness for the body of business that is really the job creator, and that's the small business?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, you know, we can certainly look at pass-through type entities and build the personal income tax even more directly into that. The issue that I think around the effect of taxes on those types of investments is that it's even more indirect, because, you know, if you're thinking about a corporation making a location decision, you know, you're looking at a comparison of alternative locations, and you're looking at this type of analysis that's going to be based on those tax rates, you know, pretty firm knowledge of what other costs will be, and there's kind of this rational quantitative inclusion of those taxes, and I think it fits more in terms of this type of analysis, whereas smaller businesses are more likely to be influenced by non-tax factors that have to do with, you know, the question always comes up, why is Microsoft in Seattle, for example, those kinds of issues that have more to do with kind of where that business started up, maybe more to do with the kind of the external environment in terms of are those types of skills available? Is it an environment that encourages those kinds of innovations? Taxes may be a part of that, but I think it's more indirect, and it's less in terms of this kind of hard calculation that we see on the corporate side.
Follow up, please.
The indirect, and it's very hard to calculate this, but the indirect effect of the culture of a community, whether it's business friendly, business neutral, or in fact business unfriendly. And I have maintained for years that culture of a community really affects the economic vibrancy that exists in that community. And we have communities that are not business friendly. Mm-hmm. And I think the role of cities and counties, local government, in terms of how they respond to the business community and the needs and time, and the overlay of state statutes that we have in terms of land use issues and the restrictions and the ordinances in these local governments that make it very difficult for these small businesses to get a foothold and to become, you know, successful. And I think the role of the small communities, if there's some way, I don't know how you'd do it, mm-hmm. but I mean, I'm not going to do it on the public record, but I can tell you those communities that are hard to do business in. Mm-hmm. They are just hard to do business. They're prima donnas. Mm-hmm. and there are communities that are not. And you look at the difference within our state between those communities that are responsive. They have quick turnaround. It's yes, yes. It's not, we'll think about it, and mm-hmm. a long, protracted process. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I had to get that off my chest.
if I could add, Madam Chair and Senator Morris, I think our next panel will probably be better equipped to address that issue too, because they've probably experienced similar kind of thoughts. Yeah.
Senator Telfer.
I was going to say the economic development organizations throughout the state could probably give you some really good statistics. My concern is the results of this study that we use caution and don't make it blanket statement for business in Oregon, because most businesses in Oregon are smaller, pass-throughs, LLCs, partnerships, S-corporations, as well as numerous sole proprietorships that are the job creators. And so if we're going to use this study to say, this is what we're going to do for economic development, this is how we're going to attract jobs or whatever, I think that's a big mistake, since they aren't the job creators and we aren't talking about the majority of businesses in the state. So I guess my question is, why are we doing the study? What is the outcome that we're looking for?
Well, Senator, I think that the reason is that we know that these types of investments are significant, and that we've just had a fair amount of testimony on that in the previous panel in terms of Washington County and investments in that area that have been large capital projects that have had a significant effect. And I think Business Oregon will tell you that that's still a significant influence on relative state economic performance. But I also agree with you that this should not be portrayed as somehow an explanation of overall state economic development policy by any means. Our attempt here is to kind of lay out exactly what we know in terms of these types of investments. What additional information can we get from looking more detailed in terms of Oregon-specific kind of investments, and to try to give you some guidance in terms of that specific narrow niche of how economic development may take place. We wouldn't see this as any kind of a guide to broad economic development policy, and I would agree completely with you that would be a big mistake to portray it that way.
Okay.
Good questions. Thank you very much. Let's move on to our next panel. Or unless other people want to speak. Did he cover it? Honestly, Chris?
The only thing that I was thinking just very quickly to keep moving on, Chris Allen, Legislative Revenue Office, was part of the context and the fabric for this is the large businesses setting the stage for creating a kind of these agglomeration economies where these businesses spin off from. I mean, and Intel is a really good example. You have a large corporation there, a lot of investment. And I don't have numbers off the top of my head, but I know somebody does, about the number of spin-offs from that, people who have left Intel and started their own businesses. So there is a relationship between all of the job creators and the small businesses, the business environment, economic development plans, everything that everybody has just touched on here. They are tied together between the large businesses and the large capital investments, kind of setting the stage for the entrepreneurs to come in and say, you know, this company is doing this, but I have this other idea that I can take off with, and I'm going to go start my own job. And they already have roots in the community. So all of the things tie together in that way. That's the only thing that I
remember. The other example that would be Tektronix. Remember?
Tektronix was a big...
Yeah. Started it all.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It did.
Constellations.
Yes.
Jenna Morris.
Well, I think we should extend the invitation to our intern.
Just so he can get his name on the record.
Yeah.
Can you please put your name on the record and say something profound?
Sure,
I was thinking the same thing. I was thinking the exact same thing.
Dustin Bishop, legislative revenue intern. I just have to extend my agreeance with these two gentlemen in what they've brought to you all, and as far as insights and to policy across state lines, and how we can make Oregon one of the economic behemoths of the region. So hopefully that can be our future soon. So,
well, thank you for the work on this project. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Okay, now we have a panel, and we have Randy Miller, Harvey Platt, and
the tall one.
I don't have my nose in front of me, so I just have to go by facial recognition.
Spatial. You're first, I think.
Eric's first. Yeah.
Welcome,
Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Eric Amos. I am the tax director for Columbia Sportswear Company. I've been in this role for 14 years, and prior to that, I was a tax manager for Deloitte & Touche.
excuse me, Deloitte & Touche is a large accounting firm similar to Ernst & Young, which is the study that you've reviewed and we've taken a look at. So I just wanted to just kind of give you a couple comments on my personal experience in this area, both at Deloitte & Touche and at Columbia Sportswear. I can tell you my experience at Deloitte & Touche was in the mid-90s when stock option gains were going through the roof and the good times would never end. And during that time, I did numerous location studies for various corporations. Income taxes specifically were always a concern and a question and the focus of that. So what we're discussing today is real, and it does take place in business. It's not always the number one consideration. It's not always even in the top five. In fact, several of my studies, as a tax person, I want it to be the number one consideration for them, but it often isn't. It's often labor costs, it's energy costs, and often during this time period, it was the CEO getting this study and saying, yeah, but personally, I'm going to pay a lot more income taxes if we move to Oregon because I'm going to have $2 million in stock option gains, where if we move to Vancouver, Washington, I'll have nothing. So there is a relationship between the personal income tax and the corporate income tax that I don't think we can discount as part of this discussion. Because it's real and it's almost emotional. Because if you save a corporation $3 million, but you're costing the CEO $1 million, generally the CEO will trump all that analysis for that reason. So this is real business and real economics. Briefly on my experience at Columbia Sportswear, for those of you who are not familiar with our company, we do business in all 50 states in the United States. We file corporate income tax returns in all 50 states. So I do have a fair breadth of experience in kind of doing location decisions for my own company. Most of them are small location decisions, retail stores where, frankly, tax is not a consideration. But we've done several for distribution centers, whether to expand our existing one here in Oregon or whether to build one closer to market in Kentucky. And it's been an interesting process. In fact, a decade ago, I was sitting in the same chair talking about the single sales factor. So I certainly applaud the efforts that Oregon's made in that area. I know it's made a big difference for Columbia, and I think it's been fairly successful in attracting new business to Oregon in general. So I think that's really what I wanted to say. I'm certainly available for any questions, since I do have kind of more boots on the ground look at what's happening on this front.
Thank you very much. I think we'll proceed through the panel and then we'll open up to questions. Welcome.
Madam Chair, Mark. Can I say Mark? Yes, I know. That's why I said Mark. My name is Harvey Platt. It's nice to see some of you who I've met before again. And thank you for having us here today. And I have some notes so I don't forget what I'm going to say, but I want to talk more about attitude, especially what the folks in our company and our family feel about what the sort of the disturbing attitude is going on. So I want to frame my remarks before I refer to my notes and put on my glasses, and you'll understand why. Anyway, our family business was founded in Portland in 1953 by my dad and my uncle, and I'm pretty sure if they knew that the tax environment and more the social environment was coming, I'm pretty sure they would have gone north a long time ago. It's been a gradual thing, but it seems to have gotten progressively worse lately with the introduction of class warfare. Seems like it peaked a couple of years ago with the unfair and largely untrue rhetoric of Measures 66 and 67, which Mark and I talked about a couple of times. This would not be something that my dad and uncle could understand, and I couldn't explain it to them. As a member of the OBA PAC board, we've interviewed dozens of candidates running for statewide legislative office. It's a great, fun experience. And I am noted, Sarah will agree, for one question, which is, if I had a business that I was considering starting or moving, why would I choose Oregon? And in your answer, you cannot use the expression quality of life. I have asked this question about 30 times and never really gotten a good answer. Instead, we are left with these kinds of quotes from CEO Magazine. Quote, Oregon is a great place to start a business, but all successful businesses move out when the founder leaves, and so does he. The tax structure drives all movable wealth out of the state. And another one, Oregon has taken the approach that during the recession that business tax revenues and personal tax revenues are down. It is not their job to help ease the burden and create easier competitive environment, but instead to increase taxes and regulatory fees to keep government in place. That attitude has crushed many businesses in Oregon and caused much of our customer base to leave the state. The magazine ranks states on their performance, and we're moving in the wrong direction. 24th place in 2009. 33rd place in 2011, 42nd place in 2012, the largest single drop of any state in the union. We refuse to understand that more than ever we live in a mobile society. We have one of the highest income taxes in the country, bordered by two states with no income tax, no capital gains tax, which would ease the burden a little. We're losing hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue and some of the brightest successful people at the same time. Into this toxic recipe, you throw in an estate tax where California has none, the insane kicker law, and the novel idea of not taxing tourists, and you have created a menu that no decent diner would serve to a terrorist. We recently sold our family business. It was in our family for 59 years. Because of our connections with the community and great boards like this one that I'm privileged to serve on, we chose to stay here in Oregon. I know a lot of others who have understandably left. The worst part of this situation is having no say into where the punitive Oregon income tax dollars will go. If we knew they're going to schools or police or another great area in need, it would be okay. It wouldn't be so bad. I suggest you consider introducing legislation that gives those who choose to stay here and fulfill certain prerequisites a checkoff to let them choose where their tax dollars go. It would make it more like a charitable contribution than a tax. I strongly suggest that this committee and the legislature come up with a plan to have the attitude to attract and make good, clean businesses want to stay, feel welcome, and make them want to stay. Fixing the tax situation is a great place to start. I look forward to the day when our system of taxation is second only to our quality of life.
Thank you.
Your turn, Randy.
Thank you. Thanks. I'm Randy Miller, to please be distinguished with your former colleague, Randy Miller.
Mm-hmm. call him the good Randy Miller.
Thank you. I wanted to talk a little bit about the almost 40 years that I've experienced in terms of business recruitment and economic development. For most of those years, I chaired the program for the Metropolitan Region, which was his mission. It was to attract new business to the area, also try to retain and expand those who were already there. And subsequent to that, forming director of what we call Greater Portland, Inc. now, which is the organization which we have removed from the Development Commission, have made it more robust in terms of private sector participation. So it's the job of this organization not only to market the community, but also to be able to try to extend the reach, to be able to attract new businesses and work with ones that are here, and hopefully have them expand. In all these years that I've been doing this, there's probably no apparent demonstration of the significance of tax policy was when we began in the 80s to try to recruit Japanese businesses into the state of Oregon. That was prompted, frankly, because of my company, which we were the first Sony distributor in the United States, and a personal relationship I had with Mr. Morita, the founder. And because Japan Inc. had indicated that they were very interested in U.S. investment, particularly in manufacturing, we started, meaning the ambassador program to the PDC, and then a couple along with state efforts later, to make trips over to Japan to try to recruit businesses here. The first thing we discovered in our efforts was the punitive nature of what we called the unitary tax. Do you remember that? And so as an effort to be able to address that, which looked at worldwide income, when we returned, I chaired this committee called the Unitary Tax Repeal Committee, came down and talked to Governor Attia about it. Without doing our homework, we found out he wrote the bill into the law when he was Senate President, whatever. But anyway, he was really agreed with it, and we were able to remove it. And within 18 months, NEC, Fujitsu, and Epson all had significant investments here, which then resulted in far more. Since then, things have changed. This state has been extremely responsive for capital-intensive businesses, and your policies that you've adopted relative to the SIP and, of course, single sales, other opportunities for businesses have been very, very effective, and we can see the results of that. Now, of course, things have shifted, as we all know. Manufacturing, which is still a very important part of this state economy, is still important. And yet the trend and the patterns as we move forward are more in intellectual capital. And the intellectual capital or intangibles is what is very punitive because, of course, the personal income tax that flows forward. So as we, meaning Greater Portland Inc., coupled with the PDC, Business Oregon, all working together, and believe me, it is a harmony in terms of concert between the private and public sector, more so than I've ever seen it. As we continue these initiatives to try to attract business or also encourage others here to expand, it has become very apparent that intangibles seems to be the key to our future. Whether or not it's with, you know, outdoor apparel and sportswear, or whether or not it's the software cluster, whatever it might be, sustainability, planning, engineering, that kind of thing, it is all very, very difficult because of our punitive system. And, of course, Frank, several years ago, when the four of you introduced the idea of a consumption tax to lower the... I mean, I thought that was absolutely beautiful, and I still do. I still think that's where we need to go. Relative to all the political obstacles, of course, I know it's going to be very difficult. But we find that because of site selectors around the country and around the world, frankly, other than the fact we have a lot of good attributes in this state, when we are trying to recruit a headquarters company or trying to recruit individuals that have high net worth to bring maybe even a regional company here, oftentimes we don't even make the list because it's so of the finalists, because it is so apparent that these people have done their homework ahead of time and recognized through websites and other relevant informational pieces that are available to them, we don't even make the cut because of that particular issue. So we do know that it makes an impact. And yes, Paul's right. We've got several different elements to what makes these kinds of decisions. But nevertheless, I think when you're looking through the potpourri of solutions and outcomes that you want, I just think that this needs to be a part of your thinking. It's going to be it's going to make more and more of a difference as we go forward as we try to attract those types of businesses here or retain. As Harvey said, that don't leave. He and I, it's countless how many people we know that have moved out or are cheating, frankly, and pretending to move out, and we lose that revenue stream forever. Is it a matter of equity? You know, frankly, it should be equitable, but the fact is, it's not. It's all about competitiveness and what we can draw into the state. So I think that's got to be a key factor. You mentioned, Microsoft and while they're in Seattle, but Jeff Bezos moved to Seattle with Amazon. He didn't start it there. He moved there. And look what's happened. No income tax. So although I think their system is egregious and regressive and awful, still we have to live with. So we still have to put up with that kind of thing. So please, as you deliberate, think about where we're going rather than where we've been. And hopefully we have the gumption to be able to overcome the political obstacles to really look at reform, particularly as it relates to some kind of consumption tax. And as a Band-Aid, but you mentioned, Paul, what Ohio's done. Jenny, you missed that trip. That was our last, you know, best practices trip. And we were just overwhelmed with what we saw in Ohio, in the Cleveland area, and the growth in industry and what's occurred as a result of tax policy changes. A lot of difficulty here, but I think it's real.
So what I'm getting from you, kind of between the lines, is it's not so much the absence of a tax burden, it's the type of tax and how the fairness of it and the disproportion of some of it. Because what I'm hearing is, and there are two really heavily single-source reliant states in the country. One is Washington and one is Oregon.
Yeah, could be
more. And Washington is to sales tax what we are to income tax. Mm. And what I'm hearing from you is the reliance on the sales tax from a business standpoint is less damaging than the over-reliance mm-hmm. on the
income tax. Just compare their economic growth to ours.
Right. So then my question is, I mean, obviously it wouldn't make sense if you could wave a wand, and Senator Morris and I have talked many times that the solution to this whole tax reform problem is just to put us in charge for 4 days.
a benevolent dictatorship is the best kind of government.
That's correct.
We're going to Singapore on one of those next trips, by the way, to see how benevolent dictatorship works.
Yes, well, I'll go on that one. But if we did succeed in an excellent system like Senator Morris and bipartisan colleagues had a couple of years ago, would that be enough to stop the flight of people to Washington? Because we still, and we couldn't responsibly just go to another single source. That's not good for other reasons.
We need balance.
So if we had balance, would we still be in the soup with people moving across the river? Because we still would have an income tax with a mm-hmm. with the balanced approach.
Mm-hmm. I acknowledge it's a difficult situation. When I said, you know, in my cute little thing, was it's a toxic recipe, it truly is, because you have, you know, no tax over there, and, you know, and the highest tax in the country here, plus no death tax in California, and Nevada has no income tax as well.
So you go to Washington to retire, and you mm-hmm. go to California
to die.
That's right. That's exactly. I think the key to a lot of what precipitates the move over there is not necessarily income related, it's more capital gains related. But we lose the future income from then on. So I think if in your platform there included capital gains treatment, and I think that could make a huge difference as well. I think that would, if it were treated fairly here as opposed to treated as ordinary income, I think that could in itself retain a lot of those types. And I'm doing everything I can, as you know, to make them feel guilty as hell.
That's good, capital and I know you do that.
If you're going to start with something, with a trade-off, with the kicker or something, capital gains would be a good place to start.
Some people thought that. This committee had a unanimous vote on a package
And I started off, I think it really got worse with 66 and 67 because it wasn't the my dad used to have an expression, it's not the money that's important, it's the amount. But but truly, in this case, the attitude, you know, it was awful. I mean, you know, we those of us that were trying to hire people and create jobs and feel like we're always trying to do the right thing felt like we were being misportrayed. And you know, there was a guy in Chicago who offered people to come there. The Port of Calama was running ads, you know, come up here if they don't want you there, and that. I know it's been a few years, but it permeated. At the same time, you have this imbalance thing. It was bad. Have a nice day.
Fender hats.
This is a very distinguished panel, great companies and super Oregonians. Harvey Platt's company, his family ran a great company, 59 years. You've seen their trucks all around the state, West Coast, Platt Electric. And he just sold it because he wanted to play golf.
But you don't play golf.
He doesn't play golf.
Okay. You're going to learn how, maybe. And he and I, for the last 10 years, have had this ongoing conversation about Oregon's tax climate. And so when I saw this study that Paul gave us about Oregon being almost the most competitive tax state in the country, I said, God, I wish Harvey Platt were here. I could show him this. And I hear what you're saying, that it shouldn't be such a volatile tax code, even though it's competitive on the aggregate. The thing about that is the very solution that you're all three of you would prescribe, you'd probably get four votes for up here, and you could probably pass it in the legislature. But we're trying to engage a public that isn't there, and that's been a very very difficult situation for all of us. We all think if somebody could just. If the average voter could spend a year in the revenue committee, we'd pass these tax measures unanimously. We see the volatility. We see the effects. And I know the governor is beginning to work on a solution to that. But until, you know, these top-to-bottom tax reform, which I think we all support, has 1,000 moving pieces. And you could take one of those and make an argument, if you're a critic or an opponent, as to why this won't work. Mm-hmm. And, for example, the Intel property tax break. And you would have to have that. So Washington, most states have that. You're not going to pay a tax on a $20 million piece of equipment. You wouldn't build those kinds of plants. But someone could take that and say, see, look at these politicians. They're protecting their friends and the big corporations, and they're sticking the bill to you. That's the kind of political reality that a major tax reform proposal runs into. And that's, I think, what we're up against. We're very sympathetic to this issue of people leaving this and trying to relocate companies here. And so I guess it's more of a comment than a question. Maybe you have some thoughts, Harvey, and we've talked about this, but I don't know how you get through that.
You find out who the most respected person is in the state and who is not in politics, and you try to recruit them to lead this.
Hmm. Well, was I interrupting you, Randy? I used to know who that person was, but I don't want to say actually who it is now. I'll tell you off camera.
Mm-hmm. I'm serious. There was a person who could have done it, but there were some news stories that made it impossible.
Two things I would suggest, and one of them was actually suggested by former mayor Vera Cass. I love this idea. And that is, once you as a body determine what might be the right tax policy to adopt, to do it with an automatic sunset in 2 years or 3 years, whatever you may decide, and then let the voter decide whether or not they approve what you've done. And it may help inhibit as some sort of an initiative, a referendum, so because they know it's automatically going to sunset. And Stockholm, Sweden, did that on their congestion parking, because it was just overwhelming how many of the citizens there voted against congestion pricing. But when their governmental body adopted the policy with an automatic sunset, everyone got used to it and found it wasn't so bad, and then they supported it overwhelmingly. I love that idea. The second idea that I thought, too, is what Paul's comment that you made a couple sessions ago, which I think had a huge impact, and that is that the message ought to not be anything other than the fact is that there's an awful lot of money floating around out there which is uncollected. So those of us that are paying taxes are paying it for those that aren't. So if we adopt such a consumption tax, it's the drug money, the bartering money, the over deductions on income tax returns, that kind of thing is what we're collecting in tourists, not trying to collect it from the citizens of the state. So if we can show that there's no additional tax on people that way, but instead we're just collecting what we should be collecting but can't, I think that's the message.
Right. And I think it's also telling from probably Senator Morris is the best one to talk about this, but when the group that did the tax reform package got a focus group together, they would start out just like the public does over here. We don't trust you, don't do anything. Mm-hmm. And by the end, they were all on board.
Madam Chair, I was the research analyst that came in to the focus group, not as a senator, but as, you know, fictional person, and I gave the presentation, and at the end, you know, it started out roughly, you know, 20-80, and at the end it was 80-20.
Wow.
And if you have the ability to get in front of people and make the presentation so they understand where we've been, where we are, and where we will be with these reforms, you can move it. But I don't know how you do that. You can't run a campaign with focus groups.
Can you do what Randy said without referring to the voters?
Well, yeah. Well, we've tried everything else. So
you
yes,
just referred to the
we
voters
could,
to get
we could,
to
the
to be
question
safe.
Is whether that would satisfy the anti-tax people, because in Oregon you cannot do a tax measure with an emergency clause, so you can't just do it and put it into effect. So there, that gives the anti-tax people 90 days to gather the signatures,
which they will,
and they have been very dependable in this regard.
But with an automatic sunset, that might inhibit them.
That was your point.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
and I think that's something to consider. We've tried everything else. Senator Hess.
Thank you. Also, there are some constitutional restrictions that would have to be changed in a major tax reform, having to do with certain taxes, ballot measures that passed years ago, Measure 5. So if there is a statewide vote, I'm in the advertising business on my other side, and to get out in front of the masses, you have to throw some major chips on the table, millions of dollars. Maybe $5 to $10 million. Somebody has to pay that bill, and if it's business, then okay, this is benefiting business. If it's labor unions, okay, this is labor.
It needs to be both.
It's the usual suspects.
Mm-hmm. No easy task.
So,
That's why it makes sense to put this committee in charge.
Michael Phelps could be your spokesperson.
Yeah.
You know, Oklahoma did this, though. They were able to change their policy to adopt sales tax. It might be a best practice to take a look at.
Let's go to Tulsa next time.
Go to Oklahoma City and see the Sonics.
Since our discussion's a little freewheeling here, it's ironic in the class warfare as you have described it, and I feel it. I'm a businessman, mm-hmm. and I'm offended. I feel offended to be attacked. But the Kansas City Federal Reserve, there were two economists a while back that made an empirical study of the net effect of raising corporate taxes on labor wages and salaries. And what would you guess? You raise the corporate rate and labor goes down.
Mm-hmm.
Labor and salaries go down. And that's the exact opposite of what the labor community should want. And it was a very, very well done analysis. And so, you know, if we're wanting to raise the middle class, which we all do, attacking businesses to accomplish that, it is not going to get us there.
You got the order.
I won't go any further.
Yeah.
Other questions, comments? Thank you so much. This has been a good discussion. It's not
over. I apologize for Randy interrupting.
And next time I come down, mm-hmm. this, so I don't have to bring you another one.
Mm-hmm. All right. I have about 10 of them.
I'll get them to you by me.
I know. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next time I want a white one.
Okay. Maybe.
Thank you very much. Okay. I think
we'll just property taxes.
Move right on. Next exciting topic, property taxes. Measure 50, property tax system. While our panel's coming to the floor, committee, I met recently with the folks from Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue and was completely blown away by the level of analysis they've done on the Measure 50 issue. Independently, it was very impressive, and so that's why I invited them to come and share it with the rest of the committee. This committee has been working at some level of intensity on this issue since I became chair in 2008. So really appreciate you coming down for this. And Christine, do you want to... Yes, the tiger meeting. Christine, do you want to start us out here?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Measure 50 has... Well, it's kind of been challenging in recent years as real market values have declined. With the real estate market, there's some indication that perhaps the market has bottomed out and is going to begin a recovery. As far as real market values go, there is a little lag between the time of the assessment and the realized revenues from that. So I think the folks from Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue are here to talk about some of the details of what real market values have been doing and how that impacts revenue streams for local governments.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Again, my name is Mike Dyke. I'm the fire chief at Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. With me today is our chief financial officer, Deborah Guzman, from the fire district. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you today on this exciting topic. We, as frankly the state and all local governments in Oregon, have been just battling our way through this economy, somewhat unprecedented, and the difficulties in just trying to forecast what is happening and what is going to happen. In the process, based on requests from our policymakers, both elected and appointed, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue has uncovered some very interesting information that we'd like to share with the committee today. We do think this will be of value to you and how you try to navigate the future. So with that, I'll turn it over to Chief Financial Officer Deborah Guzman.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to present today. For Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, as many other local governments, property taxes are our only source of revenue, and so we were interested in understanding what some of the trends were impacting. We saw a few years of below 3%, and our budget committee and board and others were asking what is happening. So as we began to try and forecast that, we went back to the beginning, and the two tax measures, as you're well aware, setting the stage for the property tax system in Oregon, Measure 5, set in 1990, set that first initial rate cap of 15, decreasing down to 5 for schools based on real market value, and then a $10 for general government. And again, those were based on real market value. Then in 1997, between measures 47 and 50, we delinked that real market value from assessed valuation and in general set an artificial assessed valuation with, in general, limitations of about 3% a year. So that was that first time where we began to move real market value away from the assessment base and created those constraints. Then from there on out, from that measure 50, we understood that throughout every county, throughout the state of Oregon, the assessors are having to make two calculations. So we depicted this on a house with essentially the left side of the house being the assessor must take every single taxing entity for each piece of property and calculate that tax rate against the assessed valuation and come up with a total tax extended. They then are comparing that to the real market value times those general governmental and schools tax rates of $10 and $5 to come up with the maximum allowable tax. And that limitation on the right side is what has been reported as compression, and that is what is legally required to be reported by the assessors. And under compression, that is what is first to go are the local option levies. We also had questions throughout our citizenry and policymakers of why is my real market value declining, and that's depicted by the top red line on this sample property tax statement, but yet my taxes are going up. They're seeing So in this case, in this example, we can see a significant decline in real market value from $294,000 to $277,000. But because there is a gap still, if you will, between real market value and assessed valuation depicted by the second red line, we still have an increase in assessed valuation and likely an increase in taxes. So we saw that gap, though, and wanted to understand again more what is happening property by property. So we took a look across our service area and in Washington County, and this is a number of our assessors produced this graph, and we saw that, like the economy, we all had the peak. The top line depicts the real market value. And in 2008, at that peak of that bull market for sort of homes and prices, we had a very sizable gap between real market value and assessed valuation. And assessed valuation had been steadily plugging along at that 3% plus the increased value from any new growth. But we started to watch that long-term trend of every single year real market value, and since this long-term recession, or if you will, slow recovery, has been declining, we started to ask what is going to happen when those two lines start to converge. And in addition, as you're well aware, that because the assessors by law are assessing based on a January date, January 1, based on the prior year's decline, we started to wonder if what would be happening is if the assessed value grew by 3%, but if, as the Business Journal reported, residential property was declining at least 5.5-6% in the area, would those two lines just naturally become together 10% a year? So in working with our assessors, we started to ask what happens then when assessed valuation becomes limited by real market value. Those two lines decline for those pieces of property. And they informed us that that real market value decline will actually pull down that assessed valuation for that piece of property so that that will not, the assessed valuation cannot exceed the real market value. So then we started to realize we have some very large issues if we have more and more properties that perhaps are getting closer because we saw those trend lines coming together. We also wanted to take a look at what was happening across the state. In Deschutes County, for example, you can see a very precipitous decline since the economic downturn. And you can actually see countywide basis a flattening of that assessed valuation. So what is happening individual property by property is sufficient enough that it's actually pulling down the entire county's sort of assumed growth rate of 3%, if you will. So we also then wanted to take a look throughout our service area and some sample properties across the state. Once those two properties start to touch, that real market value is actually pulling down assessed valuation. So we took a look at the 2011-12 year and took a sample piece of property, a sample home in the city of Redmond, and just looked at what has been happening. So in the, again, peak of the market, the house was worth $294,000. It's now in last year's assessment roll worth $135,000. Very precipitous decline in real market value. But interestingly, in 2009-10, you can see we had a $10.43 levy on that house. And then as it's declined the next 2 years, we would have, in essence, a 43-cent reported compression loss. But perhaps what is more significant in the last 2 years, because of that value loss, we've had a 33.2% decline in general governmental tax rate collected. So we began to understand that the value loss may be perhaps the elephant in the room that really we need to identify, and that we don't have necessarily an individual property reporting mechanism, because variances in individual properties may be masked by other properties that are being developed. So we wanted to learn more. What does this look like? The other thing we kept hearing was that compression in our service area in particular is not an issue, and we wanted to learn how to translate that, because as you know, Measure 5 reports that $5 and $10 rate caps against real market value. And most of the data governments receive from the assessors is based on assessed valuation. So what we did for a sample piece of property in one of our service areas is at the peak of the market, that we translated, if you will, against the $5 and $10 rate against assessed valuation. And because of that wide gap, you recall, between real market value and assessed valuation, effectively, general governments could have a combined rate of $17, and schools with the local option levies and the ESDs were able to levy additional local option levies and be well above the $5 with an $8.51. So just in this one property area within one of our cities, just that decline, as those two lines of real market value and assessed valuation have come closer together, that we are experiencing closer and closer to those $5 and $10, where truly any government or schools cannot be above their rate cap. And that is actually starting to happen more throughout the areas. And then as an example, we wanted to understand where might we be at more risk of compression. And just in looking at assessor data, you can see in many areas you have schools already over $5. We just hadn't known that before because it was over the we had that spread. And we're also over $10 on the general governmental side. So you see those trend lines coming together, you can start to predict or become concerned that you will have increasing rate compression that is reported by the assessors going forward. And then, because it is a zero-sum gain, as we keep hearing more governments consider how to deal with this economy by either adding a new local option levy, adding a special service district, spinning off park operations or a library, we're all going to be actually cannibalizing from each other, because this is a zero-sum game, especially as the assessed valuation and the real market value become closer. Then we broadened our horizon to look at what is happening throughout the state. Is this just a Portland metropolitan issue? In the Northwest counties, essentially you can see the top middle, Clackamas County, we're actually fairly close in touching the RMV to the AV. At the bottom of the middle, Washington County, you see a slightly wider spread. But this pattern, based on data that's reported from the Department of Revenue, for the last several years really depicts across the state of Oregon trend. We took a look at Southwest counties, and with the exception of a county where we did have some investment in utility, the natural gas lines, you see the same kinds of trends occurring throughout the Southwest counties. And then in Central and Eastern, again, our aberration is wind farm investment, as was spoken about earlier in Sherman County. But essentially, just across the state, we have some real concerns with the long-term economy. So then we wanted to take a look at sort of a county view, taking a sampling of counties, and say, how close are these counties together, just in terms of how much are we at risk? And at the top, we have Clackamas County as an example. We already are tight with an 83% ratio. And if we were going to predict 10% coming closer together, AV growth of 3%, and property values declining on the residential basis, perhaps around 6% based on those Case-Shiller reports for 2011, perhaps we're going to see a 93% ratio in those property tax statements and assessments that we'll receive in about 2 months, 5 months into our fiscal years. So throughout the state, with the exception of Multnomah County, where you still have a 66% spread, you can see this is across the state issue. Then the other thing we wanted to do is, because we keep hearing that we can add levies, compression is not an issue, that's the Measure 5 rate compression, we wanted to take a look throughout the state and say, what tax code areas do we have rates that are already on the general governmental side already over the $10? And so you can see very clearly at the bottom of the graph, that is why in Multnomah County, where you have in the city of Portland and a portion of Lake Oswego, you have rates that are in the general governmental side in the $13 to $14, you have most of that county at 82% already at risk of Measure 5 reported compression. And you can see at the bottom, Washington County or Clackamas, again, where you don't see reported Measure 5 compression being the issue. And again, as Measure 5 would come into play, that is local options would be the first to go. The next thing we wanted to ask is, okay, if real market value and assessed valuation are coming together, what will happen then at the bottom of the market? Let's say we get some reinvestment, or we get that reinvestment from company that in the economic development that brings those new businesses in and then drive up the prices and our values again. We found that from our assessors that the green line depicts the maximum assessed valuation, and that line will actually hold steady throughout this entire downturn. And until such time as we reach that again, for instance, if we were able to have the economic development bringing in 8% increases or 4%, we would be able to grow the assessed valuation and reduce that general governmental value loss or the state schools value loss from the point of the bottom at whatever rate we can grow until we reach that maximum assessed valuation line again. And it is one area where we looked at this and thought perhaps there is an unintended consequence to, if you will, a reset at sale if we do happen to reset at sale at the bottom of this market because of the way the current law works. So we just wanted to point that out and understand that. The next thing we wanted to do is that since we are now...
So yes. Senator Telfer has an urgent question.
Well, it's urgent in it's this slide. So when properties are below the assessed
the green line,
they're not controlled by the 3% or anything else. And so if somebody's down there, they're going to see major increases as the economy picks up.
We would hope.
They're obviously not noticing the major decreases they're seeing in their property tax right now, but they're going to see those increases,
yeah.
And then we're going to have to try to explain how, well, no, the 3% doesn't apply right now. So, but that's what we're going to see.
Based on how the law works today, if the property grew, you know, our home values or the property values did go up 8%, for instance, in 1 year, then yes, you could have that 8% AV value if you were already declining.
Or 18% in some areas.
But right.
I know in Redmond, the example you use, 78% of the properties there, that's in my district, are below assessed value. 72%. 78%, I guess.
78%?
78%. It was an interesting example that you used.
Just to add, but in order to have major increases in assessed value, you have to have major increases in market value. The assessed value cannot outperform real market value.
No, I understand that. But in Bend, in Redmond, we've been there before. Those major increases are going to be coming back. The question is when.
Right.
Right. And they will be coming back. Enough. But then once you get below the assessed value, the 3% doesn't keep ticking up on the assessed value once you get below market, right? It holds steady.
That maximum.
And then once you get back to the assessed value, then you'll start marching toward
right.
the 3%.
But it's freewheeling. It can go all over the place.
So you'll have a big increase for a while, and then you'll go back to the 3%.
But in your example of 18% increase, if the delta between the green line and the bottom of the trough was 10%, it would go up 10% and then start at a 3% click from there.
Right, but I'm more concerned with the delta being 18% right now. And so they are going to go back, they're going to increase 18%. And I can tell you my constituents aren't understanding why their property taxes are going up 18% or won't.
They won't. And it's also hard to explain to them why, when their property tax values are going down, why they're still getting a 3% increase until those lines cross.
Well, they're well below the six, the green line now. So.
Right.
Okay. So with that understanding that our concern that where we had property values throughout the state where real market value and assessed valuation are already equaling and a concern that that may continue to decline, but it's not necessarily a separately reported number, what we did is obtain the tax data from our assessors for our service area in Washington County and then stratify. So we wanted to understand what does it look like. Where are properties already at 100% assessed value equaling real market value so that we could look at that data? Where are we at perhaps that next tier of 90 to 99%? Because perhaps in 1 year those two lines will come together. And there on out. So we, on a graph GIS basis, we laid out our service district on Washington County between 2011 and 2012. And you can see very significant warming, with red being those 100%, orange being in the 90 to 99%, and the yellow being the 80 to 89%. So if you will, we looked at that as the two-year risk of significant risk for our service area. And as we predicted, essentially 1 year, it becomes significantly warmer, and we are able to work with our cities and show them areas where economic development will be assisted. Help me out.
Where economic development could potentially help keep the real market values outperforming assessed valuation.
The next, what we did is take a look at just how large of how significant is this in the service area in Washington County, and a full 49% of our service area in Washington County is at that risk area where we have a significant value loss risk. We then broadened that look to Washington County as a whole, again, a very economically strong county, but you can see that significant warming trend, a lot of red, a lot of orange and yellow just in 1 year. So again, what will 2 months portell and another 2 years, because there is that delayed impact of any reinvestment. Within just in that 1 year, 51% of the county is essentially at risk of having value loss. We then took a look at Clackamas County in our service area, very dramatic. We actually have almost an 86% ratio. Clackamas County, if you recall from an earlier graph, did have a tighter ratio. And we have a lot of property, almost 80% of Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue service area in Clackamas County is at that compression, the value loss risk. We then looked at Clackamas County as a whole. Again, you can see a lot of timber or natural areas, but within the developed area, just 1 year, very dramatic changes, where, again, 70% of that county in the entire county service area is within 80 to 100% based on last year, without even including the expected decreases this next year. We wanted to take a look at throughout the state what was happening. We took a look at Jackson County. You can see that center Medford area, just how significant it is in the developed area where we have assessed valuation. And within that county, 57% is in that those top two tiers, where again, just a lot of value loss risk going forward. With just taking a look at the city of Medford, you can see just how dramatic this economy has been and what the risks for local governments are in value loss. Broadening that look to Deschutes County, again, just small pockets of development, a lot of natural area. But within the Bend and Redmond areas, a lot of red, a lot of coloration. Where again, as you just mentioned, Senator, within the entire county, almost 69% is in significant risk here. And 32% last year was already at 100%. And that's on the entire county. Took a look at the city of Redmond. You can just kind of restates what you just mentioned, Senator. City of Bend, the same issue. The red, everywhere we have red, we have expectations of declining tax revenue on both the schools and general governmental side. Continuing throughout the state and taking a look at Douglas County, it's more difficult to see because there is a lot of natural area. But within the developed areas in Douglas County, the county as a whole, almost 56% of the county is at that danger zone from value loss. City of Roseburg, as an example, we do have a lot of gray, which represents public lands, but again, just a lot of areas of concern. Took a look at Clatsop County, relative, again, some very interesting issues. It's still relatively rural and not perhaps as dramatically impacted, but a full 30%, with 17% already being at the top last year. Marion County, it was difficult to find another color. We have 64% of that county at this point in time last year. Multnomah County, we have areas, you recall from an earlier graph, they were in the 60% range of compression in that center core, where we still have some blue and very, very cool, but you can definitely see areas of the entire Multnomah County that are very much at risk of value loss. And again, consistent with many other counties, about 41%. So with that, we had a view of one of our sample property tax statements. And again, it just became very important that as governments, we all understand while Measure 5 rate compression may not be a large issue for many counties, the value loss is a huge risk for us. And as well, we all serve to impact each other. Within that general governmental tax rate or the school side, local option levies, we are going to cannibalize from each other as we spin off districts. And so we can start to see an impact there. And as every government works to balance their budgets, we are actually going to have an impact upon each other. And as in Clackamas County, what was reported in the local newspaper, just that Measure 5 compression last year forced a tremendous amount of Measure 5 loss. And it's forcing horizontal equity, as you're well aware, because in that neighboring Westlands Wilsonville School District, the same newspaper article reported that a full 81% of the voters were not paying the full amount of the school local option levy they voted for and expected to help restore teaching positions. So again, these unintended consequences from Measure 5 compression serve to void the very local option levies that our voters are voting to support the services they would like. With that would conclude our presentation. And if you had any questions.
I really appreciate it. This kind of statewide data really helps to advance our analysis of this. It's just a what do they call it, a slow slow dance or slow...
A slow death.
Slow death, yeah.
We call it death by a thousand cuts.
Yeah, but the work you've done is really impressive, and it'll add a lot to the debate. Are there questions from the committee?
Oh, yeah, what's the solution?
Well, you actually do have recommendations.
Well, I will tell you that we've been spending a lot of time just really going around sharing the information amongst all local governments in our area and now with the legislature, and plan to do some of this at the different within the association statewide, just to share the information. The power of this information is twofold. One, is there a solution? And that's why we wanted to get the information in your hands to add to the list of resources that you have. But really, today we have a problem, and that's how do we manage our local governments with the dollars we have today and trying to forecast. And I'm sure you're aware, you know, we go through a budget process, takes effect in July, but we really don't know what the assessor is going to come back or haven't in the past until November, and then we had to react to that information. We hope this information actually helps us through the fact now, if we know what's happening in January, we can put the information in the machine and look at the data. We can actually forecast before the start of the fiscal year what we're going to actually have in revenue, and then be able to react as local governments to live within our means. The other thing is we can forecast or model, if you will, if there is a local government that wants to put a local option levy on the ballot, or they want to look at spinning off another special service district to handle some of the services that they used to do under their permanent rates. We can model those, and then amongst the local governments in the region, we can talk about the effects and decide whether it's a good idea or not, or what are the unintended consequences prior to actually putting it on the ballot, and be able to tell the voters exactly what's going to happen versus finding out later that, I know we said if you vote for this, we're going to collect these funds and keep teachers at work or provide these services, when in fact, they couldn't because of the effects of either compression or devaluation that's occurred doesn't spin off the amount of funds that we thought. So we think it will provide for better government. We know it's providing for better conversation amongst government, and frankly, there's a lot of collaboration that's occurring. So if nothing changes, a lot is improved. We hope, though, we could look at some solutions like, for example, simplistically, we went for a general obligation bond with the fire district in 2007, and the voters approved that to a high margin, and we're spending those funds to build fire stations and buy apparatus. It's not subject to the calculation of the Measure 5 limitations. Local option levy, which we've had one since 2000, goes before the voters every 5 years, and they get to decide yes or no. But we don't necessarily collect that because it is subject to the compression limits of Measure 5. We think maybe it could be explored, since we have to go before the voters every 5 years and they get to decide whether or not we're doing a good job as a local government and can say no if they feel we're not, then why wouldn't we collect those funds similar to what we do with the general obligation bonds? So, but there are many other ideas that are being floated out there, and you know, really, we see an imminent issue for counties across the state, and it's how do we really weather the storm and be able to function today as local governments to provide services to the citizens of Oregon before it's too late. While we look at what is, you know, continually discussed amongst all circles is what is the long-term changes in Oregon's taxing structure. I mean, that sounds like a big project to me. So can we do something in the short term just so we don't have to, as I said earlier, die by a thousand cuts and provide some relief for the parts of Oregon that want voter control and want to be able to provide a little bit more in services through approval of local option levy? So there's my two cents.
Well, thanks. I'm just curious. You said that you've been consulting with other jurisdictions with some of your data. Did Multnomah County reach out to you when they were talking about their library levy? Because I think this is going to be an issue with the library levy?
We haven't personally talked with Multnomah County, although I know that they're aware of this issue. I know some of the conversations that are occurring on other future voter initiatives, Metro, I know, has been kicking around regional parks, local option levy, and there's others. You know, we're trying to, we're scheduled next week to go in front of all the city managers in the Metro area and present this information at Metro, so I'm sure they'll be in the audience.
Good. Okay. Questions? Thanks again. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for the presentation.
Thank you.
Okay. Committee bill draft requests. We are on schedule, committee. Nobody ever comes back from break.
No.
We have caucus at 11. Okay. Dr. Werner.
Madam Chair, very brief. We're actually 5 minutes ahead of schedule.
Yes.
Just to remind the committee that we have our deadline coming up Monday for committee bill draft requests. So I have an ongoing list of those. And so this would be to go through the chair if there's something you would like to have introduced as a committee bill draft. We are going ahead, and same thing we did last session, where there's 13 tax credits that are scheduled to sunset in 2014. So we have two sets, one in each chamber, that would just be a straight six-year extension of those credits. So that'll serve as kind of your vehicle for looking at those tax credits, and we would anticipate starting those in a policy committee and having those go to the Joint Tax Credit Committee. But we also have a series of issues, particularly around the property tax, a lot of discussion you just had over the last 45 minutes. We have a number of drafts that will go in that direction. We've been working with the cities, for example. They're looking at some alternatives, constitutional amendment potential. So just to remind you that to let us know if there's something you want us to include before that deadline.
And I'm sure we've all heard the various proposals for changes in Measure 50, Measure 5, and we have bills for pretty much anything anyone's proposed. So we'll have a lot of flexibility during the session. Anything else, Dr. Werner?
Remind the committee that we do have a meeting prior to the December legislative days. We're scheduled to meet November 20th. For release of the December revenue forecast, and that would be a joint committee meeting. And we remember that forecast is the basis in which the governor will build his budget recommendations on.
Right. Okay. Important forecast. Okay. Anything else from the committee? Okay. We are adjourned.
You got a few minutes. Have a few minutes.